The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and by no means reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, I scrap my original plan for the show in order to mark an historic occasion in Ireland, a landslide vote to legalize abortion against the efforts of the Catholic Church, which is so diminished in its influence and moral authority that opponents of the change asked the bishops to please keep a low profile. We'll talk with Irish Catholic feminist activist Miriam Deignan, who, though she now lives in London, made sure to be back in Dublin to witness history in the making, Irish women finally being allowed to follow their consciences. Miriam's jubilant face as the official numbers were announced was all over the Irish Times. I'll post that photo along with others from the occasion and the audio of this episode on the ReasonablyCatholic.com website later tonight. A reminder that with the end of the fiscal year closing in, WESU is still a good $10,000 away from meeting its goal. Did you do your part? Please go to WESUFM.org/pledge and give what you can. Every dollar counts. A sum with a five in it will nicely mark Reasonably Catholic's fifth birthday. Thanks. Up next, Miriam Deignan.
I know we can make it.
I know that we can.
Welcome, Miriam Deignan. Welcome back.
Hi, Maria. Nice to be back with
it's
you.
It's been too long. I can't even remember when we talked last and what we talked about. I'll have to go to the Reasonably Catholic archive. So, you know what occurs to me? Ireland has proven itself reasonably Catholic.
Very good. And, yeah. Alleluia.
Wow. And yeah. You are particularly equipped to talk about that with us because, A, you're Irish, mm-hmm. and two, you were there for the referendum. You experienced all, and in fact, you landed on the front page of the Irish Times celebrating. You look just transfigured.
And I really was surprised when I saw it. I wasn't expecting my photo to be the sort of headline and it was kept on the front page of the online Irish Times throughout the whole of the evening and the following morning. And I really think that what the photographer captured and obviously what the photo editor saw in that picture was really, it captured something of the mood, and it was taken just as the official results were being read out, and it was in the courtyard of Dublin Castle where everybody had congregated to welcome all of the campaign leaders and the political leaders into the Dublin Castle, and the media were all there, and so we knew the result. We had seen the exit polls, and then we saw the count coming in. But what we were gathered there for, and what the photo captured, was the official reading out of the results.
Yeah.
So the 2.15 million who voted yes, compared to the 700,000 who voted no, and that sort of official result and the turnout of 63% of voters. And I think what the photographer captured was really, I was so moved, everyone around us, we
yeah.
were just so moved. I think what he captured was relief
yeah.
And just, you know, prior to when we were clapping the official result, you know, my friend and I were arm in arm and we were crying, and as was, you know, I would say majority of the people around us were very moved. And, you know, the picture I think captures, there were a lot of men in the castle grounds. There were very elderly people, down to very young people, you know, there were children who were wearing, you know, Together for Yes stickers, and with their parents. There were a lot of young parents with babies and families. The environment and the atmosphere there, Marie, it was something so extraordinary, something I've never seen before. And it was really, you know, it's the Irish Times said that the crowd was celebrating, and I think it was celebration, but almost a muted celebration. It was relief. I think the overwhelming feeling was relief and an outpouring of emotion, because the Eighth Amendment, which the referendum sought to repeal, that's what the vote was all about, was really generally considered to have caused so much suffering and so much unnecessary torture of women and families who had to, you know, really take their crisis pregnancies and their awful, awful dilemmas abroad, and have doctors in a foreign country take care of them, because the doctors in Ireland were not allowed to take care of them in some very horrible, harrowing situations. And the outpouring of sympathy for those women and a listening, a national listening to the stories of women and believing their stories and trusting that, you know, those decisions are not taken lightly, that so many people have suffered in these situations. And it really was an outpouring of support and compassion for women and solidarity for women and men who have to make those horrible, horrible decisions that, you know, most of us, thank God, never have to go through and would never want to go through. And so the feeling was just one of such huge, overwhelming emotion, and you could see the range of ages, and there were women there in their 80s, 70s and 80s, who had been part of this campaign and leading this campaign for 35 years. The Eighth Amendment was inserted into the Irish Constitution 35 years ago, and they had been campaigning since that year, when they were campaigning to not have it inserted and added into the Constitution. And from that moment onwards, they had not stopped campaigning. And there were, you know, several events that led to it. It really, the push for it to be repealed became stronger and stronger due to certain very tragic cases. But really, in the castle grounds on Saturday afternoon, where my friend and I were privileged to be present and witness that making of history, it was, you know, generations and generations and thousands of people who had campaigned to end the cruelty and to be more compassionate and allow these women to be cared for in Ireland. And it was the most extraordinary experience I think I've ever had. So the photo, I think, you know, something about it captured it. I had I met a lot of campaigners that evening, and the photo was obviously quite prominent, and people were talking to me about it, and the feeling was, you know, maybe that we also captured a representative, you know, of you know, not 18-year-old, 21-year-old campaigners who could never understand why this law was in the Constitution, and who were, you know, covered in stickers and posters and protest banners, and we were not part of the official campaign. I was not there in any kind of campaigning capacity. I was just there in solidarity with the women of Ireland, my origins and my family and my friends, and you know, just pretty representative of the average person who felt so strongly about this, whether they were ever campaigning or would never even consider it, just moved by the stories of suffering and wanting Ireland to be a more compassionate place, because it is a compassionate place. You know, the people of Ireland are just so wonderfully warm and so supportive and such good neighbors, I would say. You know, the Irish are very neighborly, community-oriented, family-oriented people. And the stories that have been heard in the run-up to this referendum is what has made the difference, and why almost everyone in that courtyard, no matter what their age, no matter what their involvement in the campaign, was moved to tears.
If I could just put in my two cents about the photo, just thinking about it as a photo editor might look at it. You're wearing black clothing that's almost clerical looking, you know? I don't know if that was subliminal on your part or not, but, and your hands are captured kind of in, you're obviously clapping, and the camera catches you when they're together and you look like you're praying. You know, there's something kind of complicated about the photo.
Yes.
Just
that's
visually.
What my sister said, I didn't think about that, but my sister spotted that, and she said it's really quite an extraordinary image of, it is somehow spiritually, you know, resonating, that sort of, and it was almost like a prayer of, that clapping is almost a thanks, it is something about Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
That this, you know, intolerable cruelty and this, you know, very black and white dogmatic structure that had been put in place 35 years ago, that it was being removed, it was being dismantled, and with it so much more. You know, I think personally, having campaigned for equality and a more kinder policy and practice towards the marginalized in the Catholic Church for 8 years now, being, you know, a long-time campaigner and feeling so strongly about the way women are treated by the Catholic Church, and of course the Catholic Church were responsible for the Eighth Amendment being added into the Irish Constitution, there was something more about this vote, about this result and experience, than just, you know, the Eighth Amendment and the lack of access to care for women. It was very symptomatic and symbolic of the dismantling of that oppressive hold of the not so nice aspects of the official Catholic Church that deems women as not capable of making decisions in conscience and not having the option to reject motherhood, even if it risks their life, that women were not allowed to make those decisions or have any kind of say in their own healthcare, and it was that sort of the cruel aspect of the history of how women have been treated at the hands of the Catholic Church and their influence on the state in Ireland. It's a Thanksgiving that very visible, very cruel manifestation of the second-class status of women in the eyes of the official church there, that had led and really added to the relief and that sense of Thanksgiving that this is, you know, it's not a celebration of abortion. It's not,
right.
You know, it's hard to be happy about the concept of abortion. It's a horrible topic. You would hope that no one would ever have to have one, and it's a very conflicted topic. It's the relief and the feeling of the dismantling of something very oppressive and something very cruel.
Yeah.
And that whole history of what women have endured in Ireland, and so it's not just about the access to terminations of unviable and untenable pregnancies and crisis situations. It really feels like that is just a sort of symbol of how women were treated. And you know, people were talking in this whole campaign, a lot of conversation was around, let's look at how the Catholic Church treated women and babies, and let's really challenge this claim to be, you know, caring for women and caring for babies. And, you know, one of the no campaign, the names of the campaign was Love Both. You know, it was a sort of attempt to claim that we love women and we don't wish harm to women. This is not about sexism. This is not about, you know, treating women as not having a conscience and not having any autonomy. And it was challenged so clearly and so easily almost by pointing out the hypocrisy in Ireland of the Catholic authorities, and the No campaign was mostly funded by Catholics, not exclusively, but by, you know, Catholics who reject any kind of termination for any kind of reason. And the hypocrisy, you know, when you look at the history of Ireland, where there are so many stories of how women were put into the Magdalene laundries and how babies were buried in mass graves and were not, you know, christened or named, and they were just discarded, and they were sold into adoption, taken from their mothers. Just a terrible litany of stories of how cruel the official Catholic Church, in collusion often with the state that came under its influence, was to women and babies, and the hypocrisy of it. And I think that's why it was such a landslide.
Yeah. Plus the sexual abuse crisis that had to have played a part as well. It's like, who are you guys to tell us?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Where is the moral authority? Yeah. You know, you can't stand up with any conviction
right.
and with any moral authority and say, we love children.
Really?
And we believe that every life is sacred, because you look at the evidence, you look at how children have been treated. Living, fully formed, born children were treated with contempt and used and abused, and you know, the clerics who were protected and who were moved around, and the cover-ups meant that those grown men, those clerical men, had so much more value, and they were defended at all costs, and the lives and the health and the mental health and physical health of these poor tortured children were worthless to the church. They were meaningless. And so you really, the official, you know, Catholic Church in Ireland really struggled to have any moral authority on this conversation. And you know, towards the end, most of the senior clerics in Ireland did quieten down, and I think they did read the signs of the times, and they realized that people were not at all responsive or respectful of their views, and that they were not doing anything to convince people.
Yeah, I think they were invited not to weigh in.
Yes, they were. There were still some priests, some more fundamentalist priests on the extremist side, who were still lecturing from the pulpit up until last Sunday. There was a story of First Holy Communion Mass, you know, where you have little seven-year-old children,
yeah.
And their sacrament of First Holy Communion, and then during the homily, one priest actually spoke out and started talking about abortion, and lots of parents actually walked out
wow.
of that mass, and they took their children with them.
Wow. You're listening to an interview with Miriam Deignan, an occasional guest on Reasonably Catholic on Catholic women's issues, about what it was like to witness the end of Ireland's Eighth Amendment the other day, banning abortion. The Eighth Amendment was largely a creation of the Catholic Church, and it forced thousands of Irish women to travel abroad for abortions. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Please help keep the community in community radio by donating what you can during our spring pledge drive. Go to WESUFM.org/pledge. Thanks.
The No campaign has really used terrible imagery and terrible words that absolutely bypassed the woman,
yeah.
the claim that they love mothers and that they love, but you know, all of the narrative is really just about the fetus, and
yeah.
a complete disregard for any kind of suffering or risk or context of the mother's life. The woman carrying it was completely overlooked in a lot of the narrative of the priests who did campaign actively for a no vote. And this is, you know, the people of Ireland who are compassionate and well-educated and articulate and talk to each other and tell stories and listen to these stories. So many people just saw through it and said, you know what, this time around, you are not going to make women invisible. Mm-hmm. You are not going to render women as irrelevant in this conversation. Mm-hmm. We are listening to women. We are respecting women, trusting women, and hearing their stories and believing their stories. And, you know, the church is supposed to teach that above all else, we need to love our neighbors and be a good neighbor. And I think the Irish have taken that Catholic teaching that, you know, is at the core of our Catholic teaching and applied it in this situation and ignored the more extreme fundamentalist teaching of, you know, unfortunately, a very vocal and powerful minority of the official Catholic Church, and gone straight to the root of Catholic teaching, which is be a good neighbor. Who is your neighbor?
Right.
The woman who is carrying a pregnancy that she cannot continue, or has decided, you know, and has faced that dilemma with her by herself, maybe with her partner and her friends. That she is,
and her doctor.
That we need to trust, and her doctor, yes, in you know, in, and that she is the focal point. This whole referendum has seen an absolute swing to listening to the stories and these very, very brave women and men who have come out and said, you know, I had an abortion, and this is why. I had a fetal abnormality in the fetus, and it was not going to survive through birth and outside the womb, and telling these stories that they have never told before. There are many women. One very famous case where a woman was telling the story of her termination 50 years ago in London, and she said she had never told a soul, not one single person in her life. And she was so moved by the campaign that she chose to speak out and explain why she had the termination. And the stories are so powerful. And it's those stories that the Catholic people of Ireland have chosen to listen to, and not the clerics who really have failed to convince people that they truly care about women.
Tell the story.
Everything they do points to the opposite conclusion.
Tell the story for those who haven't been following it about the woman who effectively, and God rest her soul, she's no longer with us, which is why the story is especially powerful, the woman who became the poster woman for the cause.
Yes. The case of Savita. Savita was originally born in India, but she was living in Ireland, her and her husband. She was a dentist, actually, so a medical professional. Young woman with a much-wanted pregnancy, as so many of these cases are much-wanted children.
Her first pregnancy.
She was 17 weeks pregnant, this was back in 2012 in Galway. And she was found, she presented at hospital in Galway, and she you know, she was in a lot of pain, and they discovered that she was miscarrying the 17-week pregnancy. And, you know, she spent a couple of days, you know, by all accounts, she was in agony and great distress, and she knew, you know, she was she understood that she must have been miscarrying, and that the only way to alleviate her situation and prevent further distress and damage to her body was to have a termination, but she was refused a termination. And
because they could hear a heartbeat.
Exactly. As long as the fetus still has a heartbeat, the continuation of that pregnancy, no matter what the circumstances and no matter how serious the situation is, by law, the doctors were not allowed to terminate whilst there was a heartbeat. And that is what the Eighth Amendment was, that it gave equal right to life, to the fetus and the mother. And so whilst there was a heartbeat, you could not try to save the mother whilst there was still signs of life within the fetus. So she, you know, the doctors kept checking for a heartbeat. You know, it's just all seems really crazy that they were not allowed to, and they were not allowed to terminate. And basically the law in Ireland was that you risk 14 years in prison if you seek an abortion or perform an abortion, unless, you know, there are some extreme circumstances where they have allowed terminations, but it required two doctors, and it was very difficult to get two doctors to say, you know, I'm willing to take that risk. And unfortunately, in this case, the doctors did keep prioritizing the continued heartbeat of the fetus over the continued life of the mother. On the third day, she did miscarry, and the fetus was delivered, and she promptly fell into a coma. Savita fell into a coma. She was put into a high dependency unit, intensive care, and she went into septic shock. She suffered multiple organ failure, and she died of cardiac arrest on October the 28th. So that was 7 days later. So she suffered, and her body went into catastrophic decline for 7 days. And she, the case of Savita is really, I would say, what finally drove this referendum to happen, because there was such a huge, huge outcry over this case. And there were rallies in all the major cities, and everybody was contacting their politicians and saying, we must repeal this amendment and stop this madness, because it is so cruel. And I think it is a perfect illustration of how wrong the law is to almost obsessively try to maintain a developing fetus at the expense of the you know, woman who is alive and you know, with us. And her parents, you know, towards, as the campaign started, and the campaign really got into full swing, I'd say, in March this year, and her parents actually came out, and her parents are in India. Her parents came out and said, we plead with the Irish people, for the sake of Savita, for her memory, to vote yes to repeal this amendment. And that was hugely impactful. I saw a poll of voters, and the exit poll asked voters who said yes to repeal the amendment, you know, when did you make up your mind? And the vast majority said they have always known since 35 years or forever. You know, for those who were younger, they knew that this was a cruel and unjust law. But 11% of people said that they decided to vote yes based on the Savita case, and they are now talking about the leadership of the Together for Yes campaign, who campaigned for the repeal, are asking for the law that is put in place of the current law to be called Savita's law in her memory, because it really was, it was just so symbolic, and it just summarized everything that was wrong with the way women have been treated, and the way that those opposed to any termination in any circumstances have treated and considered women. And it was very moving yesterday. We actually drove past. There's a mural of her. There's an image and a mural on a wall in the south of Dublin. We drove past it, and there were masses of people there. And there's a shrine has been built up, you know, since this campaign. And there were hundreds of bouquets of flowers at the foot of her mural yesterday. Yeah. And a lot of people almost went to her image as a sort of pilgrimage after voting.
Wow.
They were handing out stickers at the polling booth saying I voted yes, and people were going and putting their sticker on her mural. It's a very moving image if you have a look at it. And
I'm looking at it now.
Yes.
I don't know if it's the exact one, but it's beautiful. I'm going to put it on the website.
Yes, it's and so she, her death and the unjustness of what happened to her, it really did motivate people, because that's the type of situation where people look beyond the very simplistic, very abstract campaign to keep abortion illegal in any circumstance. It's you know, the no campaigners, you can imagine that so many of them believe that they're doing the right thing, believe that they are upholding values that we can all sympathize with. You know, not everyone is doing it for cynical reasons and because they believe women must be forced to carry pregnancies and shouldn't have any kind of autonomy. A lot of the no voters would really are trying to uphold values and trying to keep abortion, you know, out of Ireland. I heard a lot of people, including a priest friend of mine. I actually had lunch yesterday, Sunday, in Dublin with a friend of mine that I studied at theology school with, and you know, he didn't tell me which way he voted. I actually suspect he voted yes, but he was lamenting, and he said, you know, it's just very sad to imagine that we will have abortion in Ireland now. You know, it's a sort of abstract ideal of, you know, wouldn't it be nice to have a country that never had to have abortions, but it was not representative of reality. It was a problem that was exported. Yeah. People make these decisions in good conscience, and they go abroad to get that treatment. Or, like Savita, it's even more clear. It's not even a decision that was made that they couldn't or wouldn't carry to term a pregnancy. It was, you need to have that medical care available to save the life of the mother.
Right.
And that wasn't available in Ireland. So you can't keep that treatment out of Ireland because women were dying. So it's an abstract, idealistic, almost, you know, wishful thinking that you can have a country that would never need terminated pregnancy without... What Savita's case really helped educate people about was that terminations are not just about, you know, I have a choice about whether I can or cannot carry this to term or cope with it or whatever awful reasons, or cases of rape and incest where, you know, the woman who's been impregnated against her will has to say, you know, can I do this or can I not do this? And that's often what's focused on in a campaign like this. But the realization for people that actually it's also in these terrible circumstances where something bad is going wrong with a developing fetus, mm-hmm. and it's a miscarriage can lead to horrible complications, and you need to intervene and sort of do something to save the mother's life. And it's those situations that the Irish doctors were not allowed to intervene, whether they wanted to or believed that they shouldn't. You know, is we don't know in Savita's case. Was it, you know, ethically driven? Did they truly believe that the life of that fetus was worth saving more than the life of the mother? Or were they just afraid of being prosecuted and getting into trouble with the hospital, you know, hospitals that are run by Catholic authorities? And so it's really is the story has made it very clear that there are a whole spectrum of circumstances in which termination is medically necessary, or you know, is a decision made in conscience, and that cannot be prevented. You know,
and you know, looking at it from the clerical point of view, I've always said this, that the church is free to preach about the morality or immorality of abortion. They just can't go further than that and say it should be illegal.
Right, and that's exactly what it is, isn't it? You know, if you have a strong moral authority and really try to talk to people about, you know, the blessing of life and you know, the miracle of birth and really teach people and help them, you know, think differently if they were inclined to not, you know, grasp that, but I think most people do, then that's all you need to do, is to really teach people and help them come to decisions. And interestingly enough, but they just haven't been doing that, the Archbishop Martin, he has come out, I think yesterday, he did come out and say that what the church needs to do now is to be pro-life in its deeds and actions and not just in words.
Wow.
And so that's a very significant thing to say, because
yes,
they understand now that they have been just called out for absolute hypocrisy about the treatment of women and the second class treatment of women and the disregard for actual lives of children, that they've not been trying to help children.
It's a wake-up call. You know, it's the voice of the people.
It is. Yeah. It is a wake-up call, and I hope that other Catholic authorities come to that conclusion, you know. And the people who have been funding the campaign to prevent terminations in Ireland, to keep abortion illegal forever, they also tend to be people who oppose any access to contraception
and
oppose any sex education.
Oh, gosh. And, you know, we should talk about that, because just kind of stepping back and looking at it in the broader view, I read that this latest vote is just one more progressive-minded action following on LGBT rights and access to contraception. And, you know, change has been really rolling through Ireland for, well, you tell me how long. I would pin it to the moment when I first noticed something going on in Ireland was when they banned smoking in the pubs. I said, wait a minute.
Oh, that's very good.
So,
well, you know, they've had several referendums about what we would call social issues, where the official Catholic position has been dismantled by a popular vote. And the Irish people were asked to vote about divorce and marriage equality, and now repealing the Eighth Amendment and making it, you know, legal to have terminations in some cases. So the divorce vote, interestingly, in 1986, divorce was voted down, so still not allowed. And then it was only in 1995 that 50.3% of the Irish people voted in favor of allowing divorce. And I mean, it's pretty low, and it was only in 1995. And then, of course, marriage equality was 2015, and now the 8th is 2018, and that was 66.4% in favor. So it's a massive, massive shift from, I would say, 1995 onwards. But if you look at the history of Ireland, the last Magdalen Laundry, which was where young girls were interred, and you know, if they were pregnant out of wedlock, or if they were deemed to be promiscuous, or any kind of morally, what the Catholic Church deemed to be immoral, they were actually put in Magdalen laundries, and they were doing slave labor, and they were interned. And the last one closed in Dublin in 1996.
Jeez.
If you can imagine.
Wow.
That. So it really, I would say, it really is, you know, from the mid-90s, and it's just so recent that Ireland has started to really reject that sort of stronghold of shaming women and compelling them to stay in abusive marriages, often compelling them to carry to term all pregnancies with no exceptions and no compassion and no understanding of context or the dilemmas that women face. And so it really is, it is a rejection. It's a recognition of that. And you know, it's the hypocrisy has been exposed.
Right.
You know?
This is an interview with Irish Catholic feminist Miriam Dignan, who made sure to be in Dublin the other day when Ireland's Eighth Amendment was overturned in a landslide vote. As Miriam, arriving back in England fresh off the plane, points out, the nation is not celebrating abortion, but the separation of church and state, and, as the Catholic Church itself says it values, the primacy of conscience. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters.
Turn and face the strain, changes.
Where the shame you've left is up to her next event.
The New York Times, which has been covering the Ireland vote like the big deal that it is, with stories galore, had one about effectively Pope Francis just looking elsewhere to do his job. You know, he's going to concentrate on the Southern Hemisphere because what's the point? Europe is lost to this kind of old-time thinking.
Yes, and it's a shame if the Catholic Church can't move with the times and recognize that their teaching was not based on, you know, genuine theology, that actually the theology of the Catholic Church does support conscience, the primacy of conscience,
right,
and, you know, understanding the context of people's lives and being a good neighbor. And actually, if the Catholic Church would just focus on their real theology rather than meddling and trying to artificially construct and intervene in society and based on sexism, which is so obvious sexism, they would, you know, be a more viable moral authority, and they might actually salvage some of this from the wreckage, because as part of this conversation about the Eighth Amendment, it has really dredged up so many stories of cruelty to women, and people have been examining the theology, which is an extraordinary conversation to have in public. You know, Pope Paul VI once said that Ireland was the most Catholic country on earth. It was so obedient to clerics, and they had such a stronghold on all of society, you know, campaigning and lobbying and spending an awful lot of money, you know, fighting divorce, fighting marriage equality, and of course abortion. But now people are having these public debates saying, mm-hmm, did the Catholic Church always say that life begins at conception and that termination, mm-hmm, is always wrong?
Right.
And uncovering the fact that they did not.
Yeah.
It was only towards the late 1800s and early 1900s that position was taken, as the feminist movement started gaining ground and as women started questioning, is our one and only destiny and entitlement to be mothers and wives and stay at home? And they saw the sort of danger to their, order, you know, the social order, and started saying, actually, you know, terminations are banned and evil, and that was not their position before. And people are actually talking about this on the street. You know, I was in the pub and a young man was talking to me about this, and I said, I was talking about theology and what I do, and he started saying to me, and this is a man who's a painter and decorator, and we started having a theological discussion, and he said, is it true that the Catholic Church used to say that the fetus has a soul as of 40 days or 90 days or whatever their varying position was, and mm-hmm, that they used to recognize that stages of development matter and teach, you know, the nuances of, yeah, stages of development and understanding context and understanding that women sometimes cannot bring a pregnancy to term. And if they could just get back, you know, I don't think it's a sort of all is lost, we better go elsewhere where they're not having this debate or where they're not allowed to be educated to a point where they can discuss this in a pub with each other and have a public dialogue. It really is to the, you know, the original true Catholic teaching absolutely supports understanding that people, women, have a conscience and parents and couples can make these decisions. And it really has, people have recognized, men and women, old and young, are recognizing and talking about it openly because of the history in Ireland, because it was so extreme, that, you know, the church has infantilized women and controlled and objectified them, and locked them up in institutions and blamed them entirely for the consequences of sex that, you know, two people have, that, yeah. that men and women often engage in, you know, sex, mutually consensual sex, and it was the disproportionately always the woman that has to literally bear the consequences of it and carry to term for 9 months and be asked about a pregnancy and congratulated on a pregnancy and, you know, all of that awful experience if a woman knows that the baby is sick or that she is sick and she's still compelled to carry that because the church simply didn't trust that women could make those decisions for themselves and there could be nuances. It was so black and white. And the Irish people have called it out and challenged it and said, enough, we want to believe women, trust women, and reject this stronghold over the lives and bodies.
You know, it occurs to me, Miriam, you live in Britain, right?
I was born in England. My parents are Irish, and I'm an Irish citizen, but I live in London.
Okay. Well, you've had a busy week or so, huh? We're starting with the wedding.
Well, yes, we've had quite a week, but, you know, even though I can't vote because I'm resident in England, and so are my parents, actually, I absolutely knew and I felt very strongly that I wanted to be there. I had to be
sure,
there.
Sure, of course.
It's been quite extraordinary. The days that I've spent in Ireland is seeing all of the people getting on planes to go home
yes,
to vote or to
right.
go home in solidarity. And there were several people on my plane. I saw, you know, girls wearing repeal T-shirts or Together for Yes stickers and badges. And we all sort of, everybody was looking at each other and, you know, nodding and smiling at each other. We all knew why we were going
yeah.
home.
It's like
to vote
the
or to stand in solidarity.
Right. It's like all the women on the trains here in the States with their pussy hats going to the marches,
yes.
you know. It's like, hi.
That's what it felt like.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like. And there was an extraordinary movement with people offering to pay for flights for those who wanted to go home to vote. And there was, you know, over 100,000 very late voter registrations of people trying to get up to date so that they could qualify to vote. And there was just on Thursday before the vote, you know, every plane that came in was full of people of all ages and from all different places. You know, there was a fear or a sort of presumption that there would be a rural-urban divide or an age divide or a gender divide, you know. And it just wasn't the case. It absolutely wasn't. This is not just young liberal feminist movement, a campaign to sort of shake off patriarchy. Of course, it's partly that, but this is really about people in their 70s, people in their 80s, men from farms saying, I need to do this for the women in my life, for the my neighbors. I asked my own dad, who is 76 years old, he's from, you know, a farm in rural Roscommon. Roscommon was the only county that voted no for marriage equality in 2015, and people were watching Roscommon, presuming that they would also vote no for the repealing the Eighth Amendment, and they did not. They voted yes, and this is a county that's considered the most conservative and rural, and, you know, there's not that many young people living there. They've mostly moved to Dublin. I asked my father, and I really wasn't sure what he would say. You know, you don't know because you don't really have these conversations with your parents generally. And I said, you know, if you could vote, if you still were eligible to vote, what would you vote? And he said, yes, of course.
Wow.
Absolutely, categorically, yes. This is a man, he has three sisters who are nuns, one cousin, his mother went to mass every day. He was absolutely brought up in such an, you know, incredibly strict Catholic environment. And he said that he has been seeing young women travel to London, where he lived and met my mother, since he was in London in the 60s.
Wow.
He said, I've seen these poor girls come over in horrible, horrible situations in absolute distress. They've all, you know, they all knew each other. They all stayed with friends or cousins when they went for their treatment. They used London addresses to try and get the treatment they needed. He said, I absolutely think it's a disgrace that we have this amendment that was inserted by the Catholic Church trying to control women's bodies. I couldn't believe that my 76-year-old father was using phrases like controlling women's bodies and you know, because he was so engaged with the debate. It was on radio all day, every day, Irish radio, television, in every paper. You know, you have farmers and in Roscommon talking to each other, and Kerry, where my mother is from, talking to each other about the terrible situations women find themselves in, and the men who have to support them and help make that decision. And he said, absolutely yes, without a shadow of a doubt, I have to vote yes, in solidarity with them, compassion for them, because I've seen these people with my own door. I've met them. We're in North London, where most of the Irish lived in the 60s and 70s, and I feel so terrible for them. It's an absolute disgrace that we have always exported this problem to England. And, you know, the outpouring of support from the English clinics, where these girls have been treated in most of the cases, they would get the boat from Dunleary in Dublin over to Liverpool, to the Liverpool Women's Hospital. And the support and the love that they got from this hospital, and the stories that you hear about the kindness, you know, the taxi drivers, I heard one woman give a testimony of her story. Her and her husband got the boat from Dunleary over to Liverpool because they had been told their baby would not survive, and they, you know, they could not endure, you know, carrying this developing baby for 9 months, knowing it wouldn't live. And so they made that horrible journey over to Liverpool, and she was so worried. The testimony she gave, she said, I was so paranoid that people would know what we were doing, because we didn't have carry-on cases, we were just going for the day. She said, I was so worried that the taxi driver must surely guess what I'm doing. She said, the taxi driver, and this has happened to so many women, when you say Liverpool Women's Hospital, they say, there are sometimes protesters outside, I know a back entrance, I know how you can get in and bypass the protesters, I will help you, do not worry. The kindness of people helping these women, it's been, you know,
I know.
Sorry, Gloria.
It's okay. It's understandable. My gosh.
And that's what my father said. He said, it's an absolute disgrace that we have exported this problem and tried to pretend that it didn't happen. And really, what the result is that we, and Leo Varadkar said this yesterday, the Prime Minister of Ireland, is that we are facing reality. The Irish people have woken up, and they are facing reality, and they are being kind and compassionate and understanding that these are terrible situations, and women face this dilemma and have to make very difficult decisions, and often have crisis pregnancies that are catastrophic and near fatal, and actually fatal in many cases, like Tabitha. Yeah. And that the Irish people have faced reality, and they have chosen compassion and care and believing and trusting women over the previous control over the people of Ireland that was based on dogma and a very unkind black and white thinking about what women can and should do, and that there are no nuances worth considering when it comes to women, that they will just have to bear the consequences, and it doesn't matter what happens to them, because we need to uphold this principle no matter what. And right. It is the women and their husbands, their partners, and their families that have borne the brunt of this and suffered horribly to uphold this unrealistic and very unkind principle.
Miriam, we have to leave it there. I wish I was there. I could give you a hug.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to talk to you.
Really, always. Thank you so much.
That was an interview with Miriam Deignan, speaking emotionally there at the end on why it's so important that Ireland rejected the Eighth Amendment banning abortion. If you missed any of the episode, you can find it later tonight on the ReasonablyCatholic.com blog. I'm Maria Johnson. Thanks for listening and for supporting WESU with a donation during its spring pledge drive by going to WESUFM.org/pledge. Now stay tuned for Wonderland with DJ Cheshire Cat.